very much, Elizabeth, for that kind introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here and see some old friends I haven't seen in a while. So tonight we are indeed going to talk about what you might say is a kind of creation story, but there's really one big problem with the creation of the Buddhist cosmos, and this is a slice of the cosmos that I'm going to introduce to you. The problem with the Buddhist notion of creation is that there isn't one. To be more specific, the Buddhist narrative universe, the universe in which Buddhists tell stories about themselves, the conception of the way the universe operates, is based on the notion of it being anadi in Sanskrit, which is to say beginningless. There is no start to the cosmos. There is no beginning. There may be an end, as we will see, but there is certainly no beginning. The cosmos itself, indeed, is not even a single entity. We have, in contemporary physics, this term multiverse. That's a term that my teacher, Bob Thurman, many years ago was already using to describe the Buddhist conception of the cosmos. There is not even a single universe. There are many universes. These universes themselves do have beginnings and ends. And they are called lokadhatu, perhaps a bit smaller than a usual universe. Here's one just represented here. What we have is the actual mountain of Mount Meru, the central mountain. We have around it various continents where humanoids live. We have above it heavens, and we have below it hells. Now, these universes do begin, as I say, and they do end. They go through different cycles of arising and falling, arising and falling. And we might then ask, appropriately, well, at least, where do these come from? How do these world systems, of which there are an endless number coming into existence, lasting for eons, going out of existence, how do they come into being? The answer to that question, for those of you that read Sanskrit, can be found here, and I know some of you in the audience, I saw a couple of people walk in, can be found here at the beginning of the fourth chapter of a very well-known text that discusses cosmology in part, this Sanskrit text called the Abhidharma Kosha. And you'll see here in this verse, this is the first verse of the text, karmajam loka vaichitryam, the variegation of the world, the variegated world. All of this world with all of its differences, with all of its peaks and valleys, its oceans and islands, this world all arises from our karma. And this raises the question, of course, well, what is karma? We hear that term quite a lot. You have good karma. Oh, that's bad karma. What do we mean by karma? How could we say that karma is creating the world? Well, to answer that question, we need to look a little bit at a Buddhist model of consciousness. The Buddhist model of consciousness maintains that consciousness is essentially a series of moments. Your consciousness, even as it is occurring now, is a series of moments in time, one following the other, following the other, following the other. Each moment is causally producing the next moment, at least in ordinary experience. Each moment causally produces the next moment in time. And so our consciousness is a series of moments, very quickly passing by. According to one number, it's 1/64th of the snap of a finger. Not necessarily a very precise measure, but I think you get the idea. Now, since consciousness is moving causally in this fashion, that also means that it's being causally conditioned. Each moment is flowing along with various kinds of conditioning. And these kinds of conditionings can consist of your desires, your fears, your hopes, your horrors. All of this is flowing along with each moment of experience. You are primed in each moment of experience, in a sense, with your past. But more specifically in the Buddhist context, and in terms of world-making, there's one specific kind of conditioning that constitutes worlds, that creates worlds. And that kind of conditioning is called ignorance. Now, since this ignorance is ever-present, this ignorance is also without beginning. There is no beginning to ignorance. There is no story of the fall in Buddhism. We simply have begun that way. This ignorance, this kind of conditioning distorts our experience. And that distortion of experience means that our perceptions are distorted, and our interpretations of our perceptions are distorted, and therefore our intentions to act on the basis of those interpretations are distorted. And this, these intentions are exactly what we mean by karma. The technical term here in Sanskrit is chetana. Our intentions, our chetana, our intentions to act in the world are our karma. Now, in some ways, actually, we're saying something kind of trivial. If you look around you now in this room, it's easy to do this when you're in an urban environment. You can look around this room and see the products of human intentions all around you. You're sitting in the products of human intentions. You are wearing the products of human intentions. You've probably eaten the prepared products of human intentions this evening. All of this is the product of human intentions. Of course, the stronger claim that will be made is that not only are these obviously fabricated things, but indeed our entire natural environment is, in a sense, the product of the intentions, not just of humans, but of all of the beings in the world that are inhabiting that world that they have created mutually together. So the Buddhist image of world creation, of the origin of each cosmos, of each small universe as it comes and goes and comes and goes, is that it is created by the beings within it. Now, of course, there is an interesting story that comes in the Agnya Sutta. As this kind of a universe comes into existence, it begins just with this, with these various highest realms where the beings have not even ordinary bodies. They're sort of something like floating energy clouds. And when the first such being pops into our universe and abides there for many eons before any other beings, it's said that this being begins to develop some vague intention of wishing for other minds. Of course, he's come from a universe where there were other minds, and there are other universes around him or her or it that are populated with other minds, but this being, in a sense, is alone. And so that intention drives the production of a kind of world where other minds become welcome. It's interesting to think about this in terms of one's own individual social experience. The yearning, the loneliness or the yearning for contact can, of course, create the conditions for it. In any case, eventually, after many eons, other minds pop into this universe. But the interesting thing, and this is where the Buddhist story that tells, that relates this tale, is a little tongue-in-cheek. They then say that the first being sort of observes the other beings as they pop into the universe, and those other beings see that there's someone there before them. So beholding this other being, they think he must be the creator. And then he believes, or it believes, well, I was sort of wishing for other minds, so maybe I created them. And hence begins the story of creation. This is clearly a little bit of a dig at their theistic fellows. Whether we take that story literally or not, the point is that the world in which we live is a product of our minds. The environment in which that we inhabit is a product of our minds. A very important point to keep in mind these days with our potential ecological disaster from climate change. But there are other kinds of disasters, they say, that can befall you. For example, the kind of mind that creates a hellish environment, an angry mind, a violent mind, is the mind of the beings who altogether create these many hells below the level of the Axial Mountain. These are not nice places to live. This depiction is from actually a set of postcards, contemporary modern postcards from Thailand, which depict the travels of Magalayana looking for his mother in the hells. And it's not a nice place. There are actually 64 different kinds of Buddhist hells. Buddhists love to tell stories about hells. There are some scroll paintings in Japan of hells are over 30 meters long. I guess it was a kind of cinematic entertainment, if you like. The hot hells consist of hells that are burning with their burning iron ground, where various types of torture occur. Here you see, of course, molten lead being poured in the mouth of a liar. You get what you sow, you reap what you sow, as it were. They have elaborate descriptions of these various hells. One of my favorites, as I tell my students, is the black line hell, where the demons come along and they draw a black line on one shoulder, and then on another shoulder, and then down the middle, and then they take a saw and they saw you this way, and they saw you that way, and they saw you in the middle. You all fall apart. burn on the iron ground, and then a voice from the sky says, start again. And you come back together, and it goes again, and again, and again. And of course, the very unfortunate thing is that the lifespan of the lowest hell being is as long as the lifespan of the highest god. Many, many billions of eons. But interestingly, all of the hell beings will die eventually, and all of the highest gods will die eventually. This is a constantly changing dynamic cosmos. There's no place where you can stay forever. And the claim is that because this complex cosmos is all created through a kind of distortion of experience, through distorted intentions, intentions that do not see the way things actually are, but rather are distorted by a veil of ignorance. Therefore, all of that cosmos is a cosmos of frustration, a cosmos of suffering. Wherever you go, even the highest heavens, you will face suffering. The gods in the highest heavens, for example, especially face the suffering of impermanence. I remember one time when I was first getting involved in Tibetan Buddhism, and here I'm going to date myself, in 1982, as I was a young college student at Amherst College, I was escorting a Tibetan monk around. He was the attendant of a very high lama. And we went to a mall, a small mall, and we walked by a lamp store. And he saw this incredible array of chandeliers and so on. And he turned to me and said, "Wow, America really is a heaven. You live in a celestial paradise." And there's something, if you've lived in Nepal or India, you know, if we were in India right now, or Nepal, Kathmandu, certainly the lights would be about to go out for sure. From load shedding, I can assure you. We do live, compared to many people in the world, we live in a kind of paradisical, we live a paradisical life in a paradisical environment. But one of the things that we face, just like the gods in the heavens, is impermanence. It's all going to end someday. Specifically, we're all going to die. I'm sure that's not what you're hoping for after your dinner to hear about your own death. And that sense of impermanence is the suffering that the gods face in particular. The gods have natural adornments on them. Their natural adornments include all kinds of flowers and lovely ornaments. But those flowers and lovely ornaments eventually will fade. You see gods surrounding this Buddha, and some of these gods are there to hear his speech, but those gods too will die. They're here to hear his sermons. Here is a Buddha in Akanishta, one of the most important Buddhist heavens. And it's said that if you manage to be reborn there, you will almost certainly obtain nirvana, and in fact, not die again. You will leave this world of suffering. Nevertheless, if you're unlucky, perhaps you make a mistake, or you wander into Akanishta from a neighboring heaven, you will face your death. And then as a god, what happens? Apparently, what they say is, the flowers that adorn you naturally, as you can see depicted, the flowers that adorn you naturally will fade. And you'll begin to get body odor. This is the sign of your godly death. Soon, your godly demise is marked by the need for deodorant, apparently. And this is their form of suffering. But the presence of Buddha heavens in these worlds indicates that there's a possibility, even though these two are located in this world which is called samsara, the world of suffering, the world that is caused by the distorted intentions of our own minds, by the distortions, the fundamental distortions, the beginningless distortions in our own minds, there is a possibility for transformation. And there are going to be different accounts of that transformation. This particular depiction is a Tibetan tanka painting, a Tibetan scroll painting of the Buddha in Akanishta heaven, a very famous Buddhist heaven. The possibility of that transformation is itself actually even represented by a very important kind of practice. This is a model, a three-dimensional model, bronze model, of the same world, of that entire world system. But now this world system is being turned into an offering. This is a traditional offering that is especially made to one's teacher. A teacher who one will try to visualize, to experience as an enlightened deity. This is the deity Vajradhara. This is of uncertain date, perhaps 14th or 15th century Tibetan statue of Vajradhara, the esoteric form of our own historical Buddha Shakyamuni. His hands are in this gesture, which represents the complete unity, or the Yuganada, of method and wisdom. Wisdom is represented by the right hand holding a bell. Method is represented by the left hand holding what's called a Vajra, Vajra scepter. The complete integration of method and wisdom, or if you like, even compassion and wisdom, is the means for the complete transformation of samsara. In fact, samsara can be transformed to such an extent that it actually becomes itself nirvana. One does not escape in this version of Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, but rather one transforms the world. Now, how is that possible, that the world itself can be transformed? A key to this is to understand what is meant in this style of practice in philosophy by the world itself. What indeed is the world? The term in Sanskrit for world is loka. A world also simply means your own mind and body. And in particular, in this context, it is the mind itself that is both productive of the distorted world, or it can produce the enlightened world, the mind itself. So the key is to see what is the nature of the mind itself. If one can see the nature of the mind itself, if one can see through the veils of ignorance, then it is possible to turn the world of suffering into a world of bliss. Now, there are various lineages of practice, some of them surviving to this day, that adopt this style of approach to the transformation of the world of suffering into the Buddha heavens, if you like. Some of those practices, actually, very importantly, are also being used now in derivative fashion for the treatment of various ailments in clinical contexts. All of them, to a certain extent, point to an understanding of the nature of one's own mind. And one style of practice in particular that has interested me a great deal and that I'm doing some current research on is one that's passed into Tibet through this figure. This is Naropa, a 14th century Tibetan statue of Naropa, the great Indian Mahasiddha, the great Indian practitioner who brought the Mahamudra, or great seal practice, to Tibet. Now, Naropa's teaching is a teaching that really does point to the mind itself. We've already seen that the world that we experience is, in a sense, the product of our distorted minds. The potential for experiencing an alternative world would be the product of our undistorted minds. But in short, what this means is that we have to see through the veil of ignorance. What exactly is ignorance in this context? Well, I'm not going to give you a full account of that. There's not enough time, and maybe I'm not even capable. But I can tell you something about it. This is a Tibetan phrase. It means, in Tibetan it says, Nangwa Semsu Ngocha. It means to recognize appearances as the mind. This is the most fundamental, you could say, first step in a style of practice that helps us to understand the nature of ignorance in this tradition. And interestingly, it also very much aligns with some current research in cognitive science and cognitive psychology and so on. It's a very simple point. What I'd like you to do for a moment as a kind of exercise is simply to observe this blue screen. Now, as you observe that blue screen, I'd like you to ask a question, which is simply, where is the blue color? Where is the blue color? It would seem, of course, in our natural experience that the blue color is out there. In fact, very often when I ask students to tell me where the blue color is, they simply point out there. There is the blue color. But here's an interesting thing to think about. Let's just suppose, we'll just work with our own sort of contemporary knowledge. What we know about that blue color is that blue color is not being produced by some blue stuff. is it quiet? We would say that there are photons that are interacting with your retina in such a way as to cause some kind of a stimulation along your optic nerve, and then it gets interpreted in your visual cortex in the back of your brain and somehow moves forward, and then in some fashion or another, which no neuroscientist can tell us how, but somehow or another, eventually it emerges as an experience of blue. In other words, that blue color that you are seeing is a representation in your own mind. It's not something out there in the world. It is an appearance, a phenomenal appearance, that you can recognize as being your own mind. So this is what this phrase means. It's the moment in which you have an experience of all of your sense faculties, of all of your sensory appearances, as being nothing other than the mind itself. There is no blue color out in the world. The blue color simply is your own mind. The fundamental mistake in this context is to think that what one is seeing is not a representation. The fundamental ignorance here is to believe that all that is being represented in your consciousness is actually just the way the world is in itself. And of course, that can extend not just to your perceptions, but to your beliefs about other people, about your spouse, about your friends or your boss or whatever it might be. Oh, he's just that way, or she's just that way. That's the way he or she is. The projection not only of one's perceptions as being the way the world is, but even one's own thoughts as being the way the world is. Clinically, it's been found that the capacity to, if you like, de-reify those thoughts, to recognize that the memory of a traumatic event is just a memory, it's just a representation, has shown to be very effective for the treatment of various psychological ailments. And research is ongoing in this regard. In any case, that's only the first step in the type of practice that we're talking about. Because, of course, the perceptions that we have now are very gross level perceptions. They're perceptions that are occurring. There's a great deal of them. They're caught up in a lot of thinking. And the goal of this style of practice is actually to get to a much more refined level of mind. This much more refined level of mind is the mind that actually occurs at various points. It can occur, they say, even when you sneeze. When you, interestingly enough, although I'm not sure that would be a great yogic practice to try to develop, they say it can occur when you fall asleep. It indeed does, very briefly. It can occur even at orgasm. But most importantly, it occurs when you die. And what happens when you die is that the energies in the body move from the periphery into the central channel that is represented in this Newari depiction of the various structures of the subtle energy body, according to this tradition. Here's a little bit easier one to see. According to this way of understanding the human mind-body system, there are energies that run through the body, and they especially run, there are energies that branch out from these various places, which are called in Sanskrit chakras. These are the main chakras. And they are represented here by different lotuses with different numbers of petals. The number of petals represent the number of sub-branches that head out into the periphery of the body. The central channel is the blue one, and it's surrounded by two other channels, the right and the left. The right channel is especially associated with types of affective states that have to do with approach, or even desire, if you like. The blue channel with affective states that have to do with withdrawal or avoidance, or even anger, if you like. These energies flow throughout the body, and in the normal state of mind, the body, when one is, for example, as now, hearing speech, thinking thoughts, experiencing a complex environment, the energies are throughout the body. But at the time of death, these energies are said to enter the central channel and eventually dissolve at the heart. And when they do this, the very subtlest level of mind occurs. which is in Tibetan called the Shinto Chore Lungsen, the very subtle wind mind. And that very subtle wind mind is the most basic form of consciousness. If one can experience that basic form of consciousness without the veil of ignorance, if one can, in a sense, see it for what it truly is, then all of the other forms of consciousness are transformed. The kinds of, if you think of this in terms of your sleep, if you could somehow recognize this nature, this level of your mind when you sleep, if you could see what its true nature is, see it for it, for its own self, so to speak, you would then be able to arise out of that state into your dreams and into your waking life, carrying that same realization and experience throughout your entire day. So they say. Indeed, that's what you do in dream yoga. Now, achieving this kind, this, by the way, image is from the Huntington Archive, as is the previous image, which was a 16th century, I believe, there were a depiction of this subtle wind body. Now, of course, engaging in this type of practice is not easy. If it were, I suppose we'd all be Buddhas already. If the end point of this is indeed to become a Buddha, an awakened one, and to create a Buddha world, a Buddha heaven. Here we find depicted various yogis engaged in various exercises. This is actually, these are from the famous mural, the murals in the small Lukang, the Naga house, behind the Dalai Lama's Potala Palace in Tibet. Of course, the Dalai Lama is now in exile, but his main abode in the capital of Tibet, Lhasa, was the Potala. And behind it is a small, pretty small structure called the Lukang in Tibetan, which means the house of the Nagas, the house of the serpents. And it has these amazing murals in it that depict various types of yogic practices that are meant to induce the experience of the time of death, even while you are alive. And here we see a yogi who's in a typical yogic posture, in what's called the seven-point posture of Vairochana. Sometimes the hands would actually be further up here. And he would be engaged in a kind of meditation. His name, as you can see, is called, his name is the Chandalipa. So that means that he's engaged in a practice called Tummo Yoga. This is a practice that is meant to prepare the central channel for the reception of the winds, to open up those knots that prevent the winds, those energies, from entering the central channel. And in order to do that, you engage in this Tummo Yoga, which has as a side effect the production of a very high body temperature. Actually raises Herbert Benson at Harvard University, studied some Tummo yogis in the 80s and 90s. I was slightly involved in that research. And he found that the peripheral temperature of the body was raised more than 12 degrees by these activities. Which is, let me tell you, that's hot, right? That's a big fever. If it actually got to your brain, you'd be in trouble. Now, what's the end point of these practices? The end point of these practices is that the mind itself, which is the basis of samsara, is turned into the basis of the world of suffering, that out of which the world of suffering is created. Your own experience. The stuff of your own experience is the stuff of your own suffering. That mind itself is transformed into the Buddha mind, the awakened mind, and hence into a Buddha world. A complete and radical transformation occurs. And this radical transformation can express itself in various ways. There are different forms. There's not just one Buddha, just as there isn't just one universe. There are many different kinds of Buddhas. And in the Mahamudra tradition, one of the most important types of Buddhas that all practitioners might aspire to become would be this one, Vajrayogini. She is here in her own celestial abode. As you can see, she has a very simple one, a very simple abode. It is a double reality source, or dharmodaya in Sanskrit, a chujum. Two upside down triangles pointing downward. They are two of them interconnected. The reality source is a very important symbol here. In part, it represents what occurs in the style of practice that we're talking about. As one is, in a sense, seeing through the veil of ignorance, One is also seeing through all of these representations and experiences that are occurring to you. And they say that you go through a kind of state in which all of this is reduced to the most basic stuff that it is, which is mind itself. And that expresses itself in a moment of what's called empty luminosity. Again, the kind of experience that, the kind of phenomenal experience that you can catch perhaps as you fall asleep. The kind of experience they say that occurs when you die. And that empty luminosity, in that empty luminosity, all dissolves. In tantric practice, you rehearse this. And you will use various types of visualizations of dissolving the entire world. And likewise, then, even mantras. So one of the most important mantras that would be used in this type of context would be Om Sabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharmaha Sabhava Shuddho Ham. All things are by their nature pure. That is to say, all of them are simply the pure mind itself. And I too am pure. Om Sabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharmaha Sabhava Shuddho Ham. And from that state of emptiness would then arise the new form, the purified form, the mind now not in its deluded state, but rather in its enlightened state. It's the very same mind. They say, Ngomacharna Semjen, Ngomacharna Sangye. If you don't recognize it, you're an ordinary suffering being. If you recognize it, you're a Buddha. If you recognize what? The mind itself, the nature of the mind itself. And hence you can arise in any of number of forms, but this would be one of them. What's quite interesting about this, of course, is that this is a female enlightened being, even that male practitioners are seeking to become. A manifestation, if you would like, of wisdom. Now, as you can see already, nudity is an important part of these images. Nudity represents the nudity of your own mind, so to speak, to see the mind nakedly. And one of the most important symbols of this, in another parallel tradition that is also important in contemporary, this is a contemporary depiction, the previous was a 16th century depiction, this is actually a contemporary depiction from Nepal, of another style of deity from a very closely related tradition called Dzogchen, or Great Perfection. And here we have the, unlike all of the previous images that you've seen, they are completely unadorned. Not even the least trinket are they wearing. This is meant to be a representation of the very nature of the mind itself. But as you can see, there is male and female in union. That union, part of that union, what that union represents is precisely the union of clarity or luminosity and emptiness. The mind is empty in the sense that it is not fixed in any of its representations. Your mind can represent anything. It is completely unfixed, or maga in Tibetan. But at the same time, it is luminous. It is unfixed and capable of representing anything. The union of these two is a kind of dynamic potential for creativity, which in this tradition will be called the variegated expression of compassion. So, again, if you do not recognize the nature of that mind, you're an ordinary being. If you recognize it, you are a Buddha. Another way of saying this is, if you are an ordinary being, what is creating your world is ignorance. If you're a Buddha, what is creating your world is luminous compassion. I think I'll leave it there for now, so that there can be some time for questions. Thank you. We have about, I think, 20 minutes for questions. Am I supposed to go to 8:30? Yes.
Can you make a connection or describe a connection between the attainment of Rigpa, clear light mind, and the mystic experience as it's described in the literature of the West?
Well, Yes, the question is, can you draw a connection between the clear light mind, and you use the term rigpa, which is definitely a term that can be used for this, and mystic experience in the West? And I'm not sure I can do that, because I don't necessarily know. I do know something about some forms of Western mysticism. I do know that there is a volume that I think is called The Experience of Light, which is a scholarly volume that looks at the metaphor of light in various mystical traditions. But I can't really report on that myself. What I would say is that one of the ways of thinking about one form of similarity that I've noticed before, actually, is the importance of a via negativa in this style of practice. So a via negativa in the Buddhist context as well. So via negativa, of course, is a Latin phrase, and it refers to a particular style of Christian practice. And in that practice, a very good example of this would be the great Christian mystic Meister Eckhart. And Meister Eckhart, 12th, 13th century? Meister Eckhart, one of his most famous statements is, "I pray to God that I may not believe in God. I pray that God may help me to not believe in God." Now, that sounds a little radical and strange, doesn't it? And in fact, many translators will put the second God in quotes, meaning, I do not want to believe in my idea of God. Part of what he's pointing to is the notion that our thoughts and concepts can get in the way of the experience of the divine, if you like. Likewise, in this tradition, it's extremely important for one to not get caught in the conceptual apparatus that tries to describe experience, but rather that one drop below that level of experience into something much more fundamental. And it's at that level that experiences of light can occur. I think I vaguely remember some Meister Eckhart maybe actually using some light metaphors as well. Certainly there are other Christian mystics who use light metaphors. I think San Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross has done that. But Meister Eckhart, of course, is very hesitant to say anything, because anything you say obscures the experience. So there's some similarity there. If you like, light is also the light metaphor. It's meant to be an actual kind of phenomenal experience. At the very subtlest level of consciousness, there's a sort of luminosity to it, they say. But also it's meant to be a metaphor for complete openness, of being completely unobstructed. If there's just light, there's nothing in the way. Anything that's in the way blocks light. So light is also a metaphor for total openness. Thoughts block. If you think you know what you're experiencing, if you, for example, for Meister Eckhart, if you think you know who or what God is, then you're not experiencing God. You're just experiencing your thought of God. Right? So there's, I think, a very strong parallel there. You're welcome. Yes?
I'm a little familiar with some form of Hinduism.
Yes?
And as you talk about this and the posing of the lion, I suppose I'm wondering how much does that relate to the Hindu idea of, more Hindu, of meditation of the mind. There is no mind. There is no mind. Then you are in, I don't know, I'm sure the word is nirvana, or you are in consciousness, or in the supreme consciousness.
Yes, so there are many different Hindu traditions, but what's very interesting about this style of practice that I've been pointing to, and actually in contemporary times, I talked about two traditions here. One of them is called the Mahamudra tradition, the Great Seal tradition. It comes very clearly, has historical roots in India, and goes through an Indian Buddhist tantric practice into Tibet. And then there are another style of practice that we're really not sure about its historical origins, but it's also very old. It's from they're present in the very beginning in Tibetan Buddhism, starting around the 8th or 9th century, and that's called Dzogchen, a great perfection. Those two are practiced in combination for the most part these days. And they've also been, I should maybe just as an aside, they've also been the object of scientific studies. But so far there have not been very many studies on, there have been only studies in the TM tradition, but not that many studies on other types of practices coming out of India, other than TM. And I suspect that someday perhaps that will be possible. Some of those practice lineages have declined a little bit, but what's interesting about them is that they do have very strong overlaps with specifically Mahamudra practice. One in particular, so for example, what we know of Mahamudra in the Great Seal practice that comes to Tibet, many of the texts and scholars that bring this practice to Tibet are coming through Kashmir. And the style of Shaivism that is in the 8th, 9th, 10th century, we have one of our doctoral students is actually working on this, for example. She's looking at a comparison between Buddhist materials that are actually the predecessors of Mahamudra and Kashmiri Shaiva materials that have a number of overlaps in terms of their account of how thought works and the nature of the mind and so on. So, without getting into the specifics of exactly how those practices operate, I think you can say that both of them are pointing to a very similar kind of yogic experience in which subject-object duality collapses. And that's kind of the next stage that I didn't get into that, those details here. But these style of practices, and indeed even the images themselves, are meant to represent, for example, even this gesture is meant to be a gesture of the complete unity, not only of wisdom and compassion, but also of subject and object. The figures that we saw at the end of the man and female figures in union is where the subject and object have collapsed together entirely. Because it's thought that these representations, these are ways of talking about the ultimate nature of the mind, and it's thought that the subtlest expression of ignorance, and is, of course, is clear in the if we think about the way that the mind represents something, when you see something, it seems to be over there and you're in here. And that very structure of over there and in here is what finally collapses in this type of experience. And that is shared between these traditions, many Hindu traditions, Advaita Vedanta, Kashmiri Shaivism, talk about a similar kind of experience, probably based on similar yogic techniques. But what's interesting is that they then interpret them very differently. So the language that's used to interpret the nature of those experiences can differ a great deal. And one basic difference is that the Buddhists will avoid speaking of any notion of there being some kind of a self here. Whereas, and the term in Sanskrit for that is Atman. Whereas the other traditions will indeed speak of an Atman, or even of God, in this case Shiva. And a mantra, a very well-known mantra that will be used in that context is simply Shivoham, I am Shiva. So instead of saying I am empty, you say I am Shiva. Maybe you're getting at the same thing. Other questions? Yes, Dieter.
Yeah, so as a scientist, I am trained to see differences between the world out there, the material world, and the world in here, the subjective world, the mental world. I can see the mental world creating all internal conditions, suffering and karma and so on, but I can't really see that mind creates the external world. So can you clarify whether Buddha literally means that the mental world is creating the physical world?
Well, so
or that the physical world
doesn't
exist and is just an illusion?
No one's saying it doesn't exist, because someone who does say that deserves to be hit over the head with this very large laser. So no one's saying that. But here's the way in which, and this is actually a really interesting issue in the context of science as well. My colleague Evan Thompson, my colleague through the Mind and Life Institute, Evan Thompson, who's now at UBC, has been working on this issue lately. We might try to write something together on this point. You could think of this as the inescapability of the standpoint of consciousness. So even if you're, as a scientist, when you engage in an observation, that observation has to be made from the standpoint of your own consciousness. You can't get out of your consciousness when you make an observation. We can have a measurement that's being performed. We can have data that's being collected by fMRI, for example. But that actually doesn't become data until it is taken into the standpoint of consciousness and interpreted, right?
Sure.
So, everything that we know, and now that's at a very sort of conceptual level, but also right now in your own perceptual experience, the feeling of the seats under you, the air around you, the sounds, the smells, the sights, all of those are being presented in your consciousness. You can't, all of what we know as the world is presented in consciousness.
Right, so but I didn't create that stuff.
No,
right?
No. Yes, it's interesting. I mean, suppose, did you not exactly create it, but you didn't all, you're not totally free of responsibility either. For example, your visual cortex is doing an awful lot of work right now. And it's presenting things in your visual experience that are they part of the external world, or are they features of your internal consciousness, or is that division actually even that useful in this context? So one of the ways in which this has developed, and I'm Christoph Koch actually has some interesting, fairly accessible, popular articles in this. He's a well-known neuroscientist. You may have heard of him.
I have been a colleague in Caltech, yes.
Oh, you were colleagues in Caltech. So he's gone off, I don't know if you know this, but he's gone off into panpsychism big time, which is, panpsychism is basically the position that consciousness is constitutive of everything. That doesn't mean it makes everything. It means it is a necessary component of everything. Now, from the standpoint of experience, actually, that's almost trivial, right? To the extent that anything is known, everything in the sense that anything that you are knowing, of course, your consciousness is constitutive of that in a way we just demonstrated. But he wants to make an even stronger claim that the very notion of matter is dependent on consciousness. And indeed, the very notion of consciousness is dependent on matter. So that the two are completely interpenetrated in a certain way. We can't resolve, if we try to reduce one to the other, we say it's all just consciousness, which is philosophical idealism, that won't work. If we say it's all just matter, physicalism, that won't work. The only coherent account we can come up with is an account in which both of them are completely dynamically related to each other. So I think that's actually very similar to some Buddhist views, and in fact that probably is a pretty good depiction of the style of Madhyamaka philosophy. It was called Apratisthanavada Madhyamaka, that the Mahamudra tradition espouses in India, that either pole, either extreme won't work. You can only come up with an explanation, and all of the explanations will be contingent in the end. You can only come up with an explanation from a standpoint that combines both. Or a workable explanation, I should say. I don't know if that's a little bit of a...
Yeah, I just heard you say earlier that karma created the universe.
Oh, yes. Well, now that doesn't say... So the text I showed you, which is, this is from the Abhidharma Kosha, if you want to practice your Sanskrit. So in this text is actually written by a Buddhist school that is firmly, that is not like this later school, this is an earlier school, that very firmly says there is matter and it's independent of consciousness. So interestingly, they're saying that even though there's matter independent of consciousness, karma creates the world. So what's the relationship there? Actually, I don't know, maybe, I know my colleague Sarah McClintock's out there, I don't know, I'm not sure what the precise answer to that is, but my impression is that they're not saying that your mind like sort of produces matter out of nothing, but rather that the fundamental substances that are available in a universe are shaped by the beings in that universe. And again, in a trivial way, you know, that's obvious right here. In a more profound way, when you look at environments, ecologies, that could be true as well, actually. That if we think of consciousness as basically fundamentally a kind of approach avoidance system, Francisco Varela, working with Maturana, came up with this idea of the inactive account of consciousness, autopoiesis. But that is all based on, consciousness is really based upon the capacity to survive and to create meaning out of an environment. The meaning most basically is, I need this, I don't want that. Even a bacteria on this account is conscious when it moves up a glucose gradient and moves away from some kind of noxious substance. So that basic fundamental capacity of kind of making meaning out of the environment is what is meant by consciousness at this level. And that could, in fact, be constitutive of all environments in a certain way. Certainly ones that we experience in a kind of ecology like our planet.
Could you consider that an organization, an ordering of the world of matter out there?
Yes, so on the account of this kind of philosophy, so Mahamudra actually, so the final account in the philosophy that's represented by this fellow, if I can find it, where'd it go? Sorry, I think I've got a way to get my slides here. So in Naropa's style of philosophy, he was actually once a great philosopher, by the way, just as an aside, he was kind of tenured at a Buddhist university, and then he ended up looking like this. Kind of dropped out, and it's like, oh, this isn't working for me, I guess midlife crisis or something, and there he is, the great Naropa. So the end point of this style of philosophy actually is that mind and body are made out of the same stuff. World and mind are made out of the same stuff, and that stuff they call metaphorically vayu, which is, some people mistakenly call it prana, but really the correct term is vayu, and that means literally means wind, but it's a metaphor for energy. So everything is energy. Mind is energy. From one standpoint, anything you, especially your own mind, from one standpoint, you can account for it as mind, or you can account for it also as a kind of matter, depending on which of those perspectives you take, right? So everything is fundamentally made out of energy. And in that sense, then, this is energy, my thoughts are energy, it's all made out of the same stuff. And it's shaping itself. Again, it's sort of dynamic interaction. But the claim is that so this is actually almost like an intelligent design theory, right? But the difference is that it's not intelligent design, it's unintelligent design. It's, you know, designed by stupid minds, if you like, us. And so not only are we shaping our minds and our bodies, but actually our entire environment, and mutually so. It's all just sort of this energy in this complex dynamic interaction driven by confusion, delusion, and thirst for what we think will satisfy us and fear of what we think will harm us.
How do you regard mathematics in that context?
Well, I think, my standpoint would be similar to that of the philosopher Mark Johnson, which is that objectivism, which is sort of the story of late modern times, or even not so late modern times, would have us believe that we can know the world in a way that completely erases our own subjectivities. If a mathematician or a scientist engages in a mathematical solution, solves a mathematical problem, or a scientist does an experiment somewhere and interprets it, the particular personalities, if it's an Indian scientist or mathematician or a Dutch one or a Mexican one, doesn't matter, their particular histories are completely erased, supposedly, by the mathematical or scientific method. But that's the story of modernity. But people like Mark Johnson would have us believe actually that, in fact, mathematics is not something independent of consciousness, it's somehow floating free in the universe, but actually is also very much emerges from the structures of human cognition. It's clearly useful, it works, but it's not something that is independent of our own psychology, in a certain way, of our own cognitive structures. This is what was called psychologism mid to late 19th century, and it was, you know, everybody attacked that idea because it destroyed the project of modernity, which was to secure completely objective knowledge, to have our, in such that, you know, we can have truth about the world independent of our emotions or our feelings or our tastes or anything else. But it seems like, actually, ironically, science itself is bringing some of that back. We're finding out that cognition independent of affect doesn't really work very well. And that the structures of the mind, as it turns out, seem to be fundamentally involved in everything we do, especially all of our acts of knowing the world. I hope that
answers. That's something to think about.
That's something to think about. Yeah.
Thank you.
Or
so
not
much.
Think about.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much. Enjoy tonight. I hope you'll take a look on our website or take one of these flyers with you. We have some other really fascinating programs coming up. On November 11th, Marco Gaslani, who's with the Department of Religion here at Emory, is going to be doing a lecture on the late Vedic notion of sacrifice as creation. And there's a wonderful graduate student in the religion department, Andani Salinas, is going to be looking at a beautiful image of Vishnu resting on the cosmic ocean. In our collection, that's on November 6th at 4 o'clock. You can enjoy chai and goodies at 4 o'clock and learn about the cosmic ocean as the place of creation. And
Vishnu dreams the world.
Vishnu dreams the world. So pick up one of these calendars or check out the website, fill out your email address on the clipboard that was going around, and come back next time. Thank you so much.